Hello, today is Friday, May the 10th, 1985. My name's Earl Chess, and I'm an alcoholic. I invite you to listen to the 1985 Congressional Luncheon at the United States Capitol in Washington, D.C., and I thank you, and I hope you like this tape.
Started, but I just want to say a word of public appreciation for my friend over here that introduced me. He's my chaplain in some ways and my right hand in my work. And I don't publicly get a chance to salute that man, but he has helped me in more instances, and I wanted to publicly acknowledge my colleague over here. Now, let us pray. Almighty God, creator of all people and source of wisdom and strength, bless our coming together. We acknowledge, O God, that you encourage us to use our talents and abilities in the service of others. And we pray your benediction today on all of God's creation. Help us to do those good things that bring better understanding between peoples and nurture among the nations. As we have received from your divine hand the opportunities for doing good and helping others, so remind us of our responsibilities to do justice, to love mercy, and ever walk humbly with you. This we pray. Amen.
For the 1985 Congressional Luncheon, I'm glad you all are here. It's much better since you all showed up than just me and Tom and Hal Marley. The purpose of the luncheon is to provide the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and to invite friends of ours who are friends of AA to come and join us. And I'd like to introduce a couple of those people who are our special guests today. And I'd ask that you make them feel welcome. Ms. Christine Lubesky, Director of Policy and Plans, National Council on Alcoholism. Christine, where are you? Okay. General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous, Garrett Taylor. Garrett? Senate Subcommittee, Alcoholism and Drug Abuse Staff Director, John Dudesky. John? Formerly Deputy Director of NIAAA and just recently appointed to the White House, Lauren Archer. Lauren Archer. Editor, Alcoholism Report, Jay Lewis. Chief Psychiatrist, Federal Aviation Administration, Dr. Bart Packel. Bart? I'm flying to Texas next week. You keep them guys sober. Helen Glenn, Director, U.S. Army Alcohol and Drug Abuse Program. Helen? Okay, I hope I haven't missed anyone. There is one other person I want to introduce, and that would be someone who's been around here a lot longer than most of us, the former congressman from Arkansas, former chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Wilbur Mills. For some welcoming remarks, I'd like to call on a member of Congress from the 8th Congressional District of the State of Washington, the Honorable Rod Chandler.
Congressman Mills, ladies and gentlemen, it's indeed a pleasure and an honor for me to greet and welcome all of you here today. My remarks will be brief because we have an excellent speaker to whom I have to apologize because, as the former congressman knows, weekends are for us to go home and explain what it was we did to him during the week. I have to catch a plane and go do that. And my district is a little farther away than Arkansas. It's 5 hours by plane. But I wanted to say that when I first came here to Washington 2.5 years ago, right after the 1982 election, there were a couple of things going on with me. One was I had butterflies in my stomach, no make that eagles, nervous about this whole process, and a number one priority was to find a good Alcoholics Anonymous group to which I could belong and become a part of. So I did what everybody ought to do. I thought about all the ways that I could make contact with AA members, especially around Capitol Hill. Well, I ruled out the idea of sending a letter to all of my new colleagues saying, do you know Bill Wilson? I thought, they probably all know a Bill Wilson, and that would just confuse the thing. And besides, then they'd know full well that I really did grow up in Fruitdale, Oregon, which I did. So instead of that, I found the house chaplain, the gentleman who gave our prayer today, which reminds me of a story that I'd like to share with you. There was this lady who was a widow and lonely and wanted some companionship, so she went to a pet store, and the fellow suggested a parrot to her. And he said, this is a talking parrot. Well, she took it home, and it was kind of cute, but this parrot, all it would ever say was, hi there, I'm a swinger. Well, at first, this was fun, but, you know, when her minister came over and he heard that, hi there, I'm a swinger, and when the ladies came for bridge, it really got to the point where it was just about too much. So this lady took this parrot to see her priest and suggested to him, there must be something that can be done about this parrot. And he says, you know, I think I have the answer. I have two parrots. All those parrots do, they're both men, and all they do is they sit in their cage and they repeat the rosary over and over and over again. And I'll put her in that cage with those two parrots and we'll get her some religion. So he did that and put the little parrot, and she struts in and says, hi there, I'm a swinger. And this one parrot said to the other, drop the beads, Charlie, our prayers are answered. So, in 1982 and early 1983, my prayers were answered, too, because I found, as I knew I would, right here in Washington, D.C., and as I didn't expect, right here on Capitol Hill in a subcommittee room over there in the Capitol building, a home group in Alcoholics Anonymous, right where I belong. And it's been my pleasure to become friends with all of you. Now, if you're not a member of AA, then let me just tell you that what you're doing is you're sitting in a room that's filled with love and caring and concern. And what we're up to is we're just living normal lives as best we can, helping one another to overcome a deadly illness that we couldn't overcome by ourselves. That's all there is to this. Thank you very much. And again, I apologize for having to leave early.
Thank you, Rod. He had asked me to announce that we are not related. I only told about a dozen people, and he went around all over town and says, no, we're not. So, we have the last name. You know, he's a good-looking, he's a congressman. I think he's got a little money, and I was trying to claim kinfolks with him. To introduce the speaker, I will now call on Hallium.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Hal Marley. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. And I try to live an attitude of gratitude because I got so much to be grateful for. And I look around this room, and I'm especially grateful for this afternoon because you're over 200 recovered alcoholics and friends who I love and understand. And most of you, with a few exceptions, love and understand me. And I'm very fortunate today for the privilege of introducing our speaker. I've had the privilege of knowing Tom for a number of years. And Tom's one of these A members, dedicated. He walks the way he talks, and he's been very active in Alcoholics Anonymous throughout the United States and Canada. I could go on for quite a length of time sharing with you his various accomplishments, but I won't. Suffice it to say, he is presently the director of the Cameron Morrison Facility for Youth. Is that right? Close enough. Close enough for government work. We're here in
the
government.
I got the right state.
In Hoffman, North Carolina. Now, this is a correctional institution where over 400 juveniles are sent. So Tom spends his days there trying to help over 400 kids straighten out their lives. Now, as his story unfolds, I think you'll agree that here is a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. So please join me in giving Tom a big Washington welcome. Tom?
Folks, thank you very much. I'm Tom Ivester, and I'm an alcoholic. Delighted to be here. It's a privilege, a pleasure, and I genuinely mean it. It's an honor to be here. And I'm just delighted. And Congressman, thanks so much for the lead-in. Distinguished guests, I believe. This is really a fine group assembled, and I'm delighted to have the privilege of sharing with you. As you gathered from Hal's introduction, essentially what I'm going to do today is... Is share with you my experience. I don't plan to make a speech, don't plan to preach. We'll let Dr. Ford take care of that. What I plan to do is to share my experience. I was thinking about a paradox is something that ain't just what it seems to be. A paradox, and that's one of the things that we make great stock of in Alcoholics Anonymous, paradoxes, and there are many in our program. We die to live. And is there one of us who has gone through the experience or gone with someone through the experience or observed one going through the experience who doesn't know what that means? We die to live. We literally do. And it's only when the will is dead that this program starts to work for us. It seems to be that way. I heard a thing said one time that what God would use, he first reduces to nothing. Is there a place in this world that that example is more beautifully personified than here? We die to live. We surrender to win. Strange thing that many of us refer to something called working the program. But I've come to believe, based on my own experience, that we don't work the program. It's when the will dies and surrender occurs that we allow the program to work. We surrender to win. We give it away to keep it. That's true in a lot of things in life, and it's so beautifully true in Alcoholics Anonymous. We give it away to keep it. I had somebody tell me early on that the only way you keep this program is by giving it away. And when the first people penetrated me and started to give in a beneficial, in a meaningful kind of way, and I tried to react with expressions of appreciation, the admonition then and now was that you'll never be able to pay back a single person for a single thing that they do for you in this program. That is not the way it works. If you appreciate it, you pass it on. That's some of what I want to do here today, is try to pass it on, what someone gave me. Paradoxes. Things ain't always what they seem to be. I believe, don't have any real basis for this, but I believe that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is the most remarkable fellowship that this world has ever known. I know that for sure in regards to a movement that involves and changes the lives of alcoholics. I don't think there's ever been anything that's quite like this. A remarkable program started in 1935 with two drunks. And that chain reaction of sharing and caring that occurred between those two fellows has literally reached around the world. Remarkable program. Here I am from North Carolina, fellowshipping, breaking bread, sharing with fellow alcoholics in Washington, D.C., from all over, from Seattle, Washington, Minnesota, and God only knows where else. Truly remarkable thing. I count it the greatest miracle of my life that this chain reaction incorporated me a little over 28 years ago and introduced me to a way of life beyond anything I ever dreamed. And that's essentially what I want to share with you today. It really is a remarkable program. Now, this, I kept pressing the congressman for who was in this group today. And I wanted him to sort of get me acquainted with who you were, because most of y'all I never saw before in my life. And you're a fine-looking bunch. Cleaned up real good. But now let's look a little deeper. Who are we? I gather that we are essentially about 99.44% pure alcoholics. That ain't exactly a status symbol yet. Unless you're in show business. Now, if you ain't been to the Betty Ford Clinic, you ain't hitting on nothing in show business. It normally is not a status symbol, though. Who are we? We're alcoholics. We are self-professed basket cases. Ask any of us, and we'll tell you that's exactly who we are. We'll tell you in gory detail where we came from. And where we came from does not get you to the Rayburn Building. Now, you can believe that. Nor to the Capitol. You can be sure of that. Who are we? Self-professed basket cases. Folks who have made capital of failure. Every one of us has known that. We've died to live. Who are we? There are people in this room, and I don't want to make you nervous, but there are people in this room of every political persuasion. There are people in here of every religion and none. There are people in here of different nationalities. There are people in here of different colors. I wouldn't even be surprised if there weren't people here of different languages. There are people in here of different levels of education. I'll guarantee you that there is at least one more PhD. At least. There are people in here with more letters behind their names than in them. And fellow alcoholics, there are folks in here that can barely read and write. There are folks in here that have got more money than they can count. And there's some folks in here that are dead slim broke. Somebody bought their lunch ticket. That's a fact. There are women, men, young, old, homosexual, heterosexual, asexual. What the fuck's that? Asexual. That's when you're over the hill, I guess. Differences. God, the differences that are here, you don't have to multiply the whole world. Just look at this microcosm of our society here. This is the only place in the world I know where there's an inverse pecking order. You know what I mean? This place is the only place that I know where the worse your credentials, the better you're welcome. If you ain't been reduced to nothing, you just forget it. You, PhD's dime or dozen. But you let somebody walk in the door and say, well, I just got out of the nut house. I chopped up my mom-in-law. I said, well, come on in. Let's have some coffee. I mean, there's some really strange things about this program. Now, that establishes, in a way, who we are. You know, neurotics, egos, prima donnas, wall to wall. There ain't no rules. Ain't nobody told us nothing to do. Ed said he hoped to start and stop on time. That's all. He didn't tell me what to say and not to say. No rules. There ain't nobody in charge. Hal thinks he is. But nobody's in running this thing. By any rational standard, we ought to have a riot before 2 o'clock. But in a little over 28 years, and this is a God's truth, I've seen two fights. Now, I don't mean arguments, God, I see those on the plane, you know. But I mean sure enough good old fights like we used to enjoy, you know. One of them was a fellow got testy with the way he was being sponsored, and he slipped out at intermission at an eating meeting and got him a couple sips of inhibition remover. And it came in and just thumped the dog out of his sponsor. I shouldn't say that in front of Daryl as a fellow that I'm working with there. The other one was over God. Now, drunks will fight over God in a heartbeat. This one was, I was working with a group at the state penitentiary in Raleigh, North Carolina. And working with a group there quite intensely. And one night, we had a discussion about the great freedom we have in Alcoholics Anonymous to believe, and it's an important freedom, to believe as we're able to believe. And one guy took sort of liberal license with that. And he said that his higher power was the chair he sat in because it held him up, you know, and that made sense, and he could understand that. But there was a good old straight-laced fundamental Baptist sitting in that group, and he couldn't stand that. He took umbrage to that guy's God, and they got in a fight, I mean, absolutely, down in the floor, rolling and punching. I'm saying, get loose, God, we got a meeting to run here. Let me tell you the punchline of that story. Guess what happened to the two guys? Tells you something about the strange nature of our program. The one who had the very traditional straight-laced belief died drunk about 5 years later. That idiot, rebellious character who believed a chair was God then, ain't had a drink since. He publishes a newspaper in the state of North Carolina. We're a newspaper. Now, we're... But isn't it strange? What God would do is he first reduces to nothing. It really is a remarkable program. A remarkable program. I was sitting in my house October the 26th, 1984. The phone rang. The fellow on the other line, at the end of the line said, no hello, no greeting, no nothing, no how you doing. He said, October the 26th. I have AA meetings to go to, thank God. Where would I be without them? So forth. Those of you who like that little black book that many of us use, that One Day at a Time book, will recognize that. That happens to be my favorite of the thoughts for the day. And the man on the other end of the line was a former street drunk who operated on Michigan Avenue in Detroit, Michigan. And he heard me say 20 years earlier that that was my favorite of the thoughts. Now, I do a lot of traveling. I've never been anywhere in this world on October the 26th for the last 20 years that man hasn't called me and done exactly that. He's called me out of meetings that nobody could call me out of. A remarkable program, not only in some of its ironic twists, but where in the world would you find that kind of commitment, loyalty, and devotion? The kind of sharing and caring and loving that these fellows were talking about. That's what it's about, a truly remarkable program, and I'm deeply grateful to be a part of it. I hope you can gather when I tell you that I've been sober for a little over 28 years that I started young. I did. I had my first drink as a young. I don't even remember it. We lived with my grandparents when I was a small child in Oconee County, South Carolina. And I think that's the place that Erskine Caldwell wrote about in some of his books, Tobacco Road and God's Little Acre, that red clay, devastated soil that was the finest thing that ever happened to it was they built a nuclear plant. It didn't explode, but next best thing, they flooded the thing and it just almost disappeared. During the Depression, my family, like every family, got in bad shape, and they took up the whiskey business. And my grandfather was a whiskey maker of some note in Oconee County, South Carolina. My mother tells me that the first time I ever took a drink in my life, I was 4 years old. I obviously don't remember that. But she says there were a bunch of guys sitting out under those huge pecan trees on our old farm place, still sitting there. And a little kid walked by, and there were a circle of drunks. I don't know what it is about drunks, but there were a circle of drunks sitting around there. And one of them said, "Let's see if the kid will take a drink." And what they had was Rockin' Rye whiskey. I don't even know if they still make that stuff or not, but it's nice-looking stuff. It's got stuff floating in it, hard candy and orange slices. And she said, "I took to it right good. Got drunker than a billy goat, passed out, threw up. And when I woke up, they said, 'Let's see if he learned his lesson.' She said, I reached out for it with both hands." Now, I don't believe I was born an alcoholic, but when I first got in AA, and I thought back and I understood that the alcoholism folks could tell you profoundly about this, but I at one time thought getting drunk was what alcoholism was about. And when I first made that sort of infantile connection, I said, God, I must have been born that way, because that was the story of my life. From that point forward, every time I ever took a drink, have a good trip, Rod. Eat some of that diazinon crab or whatever your wife told me about in Seattle. Isn't that cruel, a fella trying to get very sneakily go out? So I thought maybe I must have been born that way, because if getting drunk is what it's about, then certainly I must have been. But I don't believe that's what it is. I think there are two things that are required for alcoholism to occur. One of them's alcohol. I've never seen an alcoholic who didn't drink. I've seen some who said they thought they were, but they weren't sure because they never had taken a drink. But I think alcohol is required. I don't believe you can get there without it. But I don't think that's enough, because an awful lot of people drink. In fact, most people drink, and most people who drink simply do not become alcoholics, and probably never will. They enjoy it. They seem to do it rather well. I mean, amateurishly, but rather well. You know, they don't throw up on things. That, you know, they do all right. I'm all for it. I encourage drinking. I like to see folks drink. After all, that's where we get our members, you know. But most people are not going to become alcoholics. So I don't think alcohol is enough. I don't think drinking is enough for some people. They just can't drink enough long enough to make it. They stay in the minor leagues. I think the other thing that's required, though, is a predisposed personality. I believe that. I think there's a certain kind of personality that reacts favorably to alcohol, such that drinking is never an unimportant event. Talk to alcoholics. Most alcoholics can tell you explicitly where they took their first drink, who they were with. They can tell you in no uncertain terms the feeling that happened. Like Clancy talks about that boom that goes off and you feel it in your toenails. Big deal for us. And I think that's what it is. That's what happened to me as a youngster. I don't know if it at four or not. But later on in my life, when I started to drink with purpose, I think that was the purpose. I drank because I was uncomfortable. I was not content with life. I was a kid who was lacking in some of the things that seemed to be built into other people. I had that sense of uneasiness and discomfort with life. And booze for me was a great solution for that. I've had two phases in my drinking. One I call problem drinking. I've never had a normal drink in my life. I don't remember ever in my life taking one drink and having the feeling of satisfaction and saying, well, that's enough. I don't remember that in my entire life. I don't ever remember agreeing with anybody who told me I didn't need a drink. I've been so drunk I couldn't lay on the floor. And somebody say, don't you think you've had enough? And you know what I'd say. One more. I don't believe I was born an alcoholic, but I was a problem drinker almost immediately. With me, it lasted about 2 years. I started problem drinking in my 16th year. And in my 18th year, I became an alcoholic. Now, I believe this is not a profound discussion of alcoholism, but I believe this. My understanding of alcoholism is pretty fundamental.
and it's pretty simple. I think there are two essential parts to it. One, I think there is a mental side to alcoholism. Now, I don't think it's purely a mental health problem. I'm not one who believes that it's a problem for whom drinking is only a symptom of the disease. I don't believe that. I believe that there is a mental side to it, a mental obsession, if you will. That's a very distinct part of this disease. Now, I can't explain a mental obsession. I can describe it, though. Let me describe to you what a mental obsession is in my view. There's a place in our book, and those of you who study the book will recognize it, even though I can't quote it well, a place in our book where it says, to each one of us who recovers, there will come a time when the urge to drink will be so powerful that no human power will be sufficient. Now, that's a fact. That is an absolute fact, and I believe it. I believe it based on my own experience, like most things I believe. I'd been sober 3.5 years. And I had occasion to make a plane trip. The first plane trip that I had made sober in my short adult life. Sober. The first plane trip I had ever made on a jet plane. So I was naturally a little anxious. I was a little uptight. And I got on the plane, and it just shows you how things happen. Now, you know, I wasn't familiar with folks serving booze. I guess they served it when I was drinking, but I was always usually passed out or something. So I wasn't familiar with that too much. And we started to take off, and you know how the jets do. They just go straight up. And the poor little old girl, they don't even get up. Now, you tell what their business is. They cut the fares, but they ain't cut the price of whiskey a lick. They start selling it before the thing even gets off the ground. You know, you see the poor little girl back there trying to push that buggy up the aisle. Now, I was sitting at the front of the plane, first time sober on a jet plane. And the little girl is back there grunting with the buggy, trying to get it up the aisle. And she's saying scotch, bourbon, beer, and all this stuff there. The drinks were $1 a piece. That's how long ago it's been. $1 a piece. Now, I reached in my billfold, and I pulled out a $1 bill. Now, don't ask me where it came from. I'd been 3.5 years sober. I was as active as any member of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever seen. I went to a meeting the night before. I was going to a meeting that night. I had no crisis. I wasn't even married. But how do you have crisis? So yeah, I took $1 out. Look at that. Boy, that's how the program works. I don't even have $1 anymore. At least the thing I got's a 20, folks. I took $1 out and put it in my shirt pocket. Now I'm in trouble. I'm an alcoholic who has very little resistance. That's the first genuine urge that I had to have a drink in 3.5 years. Now, that's an obsession. That was not an idle thought of wouldn't it be nice to have a drink. That was an obsession. That was the sweaty hands. That was the clamor. That was the confusion. That was the fear. That was the overwhelming awareness that I needed a drink. And I had one 3.5 years. I'm in trouble. Well, what do you do? You know, by now I'm 20,000 feet in the air. What do you do? Call your sponsor? Go to a meeting? Drop by the club? Forget it. What they talked about in the book hit me that day. What I did, thank God, listen when you're not in panic. Listen in these meetings and soak in what you hear. Because you never know when you're going to need it. Almost by instinct, the fog started to clear and I remembered some things I'd heard. And I thought back to the last time I took a drink. God, what a travesty. And I remembered that. And then I said a prayer. And it wasn't much of a prayer, Dr. Ford. Only the greatest prayer that man's ever uttered. God, help me. And he did. He really did. Almost at once, I felt a sense of calm. The little girl came up, and I was so naive, I didn't even know. I said, do you have coffee? She said, yes, sir. It acted surprised, because I was about the only one wanting any. She brought it to me, and wouldn't even let me pay for it. That's what a mental obsession's about.
An alcoholic's mind is a weird place. I'm not sure that you ought to allow them out without a leash on them or something. Alcoholics think funny. And that's what a mental obsession's about. It requires no provocation at all. There's just something about the way we think that will cause us almost without stimulus. There must be something. But no, there has to be no triggering event. No crisis, no calamity, no holiday. Almost without stimulus. An overwhelming urge to take a drink. That happened to me in my 18th year. Now, I think interlaced into that was some of the problem drinking years. But in my 18th year, I developed a full, bona fide case of alcoholism. And I believe there is another side to alcoholism. I believe there's a physical side. I believe that there is something about an alcoholic that becomes physically different than other people. And with an alcoholic, there's something happens that we either wear out or something changes sufficient that we start to physically react differently to drinking than other drinkers. I know that in my 18th year, I started to experience a thing called craving, and I was never to be the same again to this day. Other drinkers do not experience craving. Now, I don't understand it, craving either, but I know exactly what it feels like. It's the absolute proven experience that if I take one drink, today I will get drunk. Now, it may not be today. My resistance may be high enough after 28 years that I could hold on for a while, maybe. But that's what craving's about, that if I take one drink, that compulsion sets up. The allergy to alcohol that is uniquely mine, mentally, physically different. I don't believe that physically, by any measure, I'm any different than other people except where it comes to alcohol. I don't look any different. I don't metabolize cantaloupe any different than other people. But somehow, when it comes to alcohol, I have a peculiar reaction. The good news is that will never bother me as long as I live, provided I don't take one drink of anything. And I've tried everything from VO to Vitalis. They all do the same thing. The rest of it is the matter of maintaining decent equilibrium. Maintaining the mental attitude such that I don't need to drink. But that's what happened to me by the time I was 18 years old. And from the time I became an alcoholic, my life was to never be the same. And from that point on, there were 1,000 bizarre, unbelievable, shameful, embarrassing, ludicrous, disgusting, mind-boggling things that happened. The traditional, normal story of an alcoholic. But I think the thing that really happened. Now, what is it? When you think back over the alcoholism, what is it that you suppose makes a guy after many years sober? Pray God that it'll be at least that many more years. What do you suppose it is that motivates us and propels us, stimulates us to hang on to this program and continue to work? What is it? Fear of dry heaves again? Oh, they were unpleasant, but I barely remember it. Remembered some. The fear of DTs. The fear of losing a job. I'm almost eligible for retirement. The fear of losing my wife. My wife has never seen me drink. She knows I did. She knows I act strange, drunk or sober. She's never seen me drink. My alcoholism to her is about like watching Days of Our Lives or As the Worm Turns or whatever those things are. She knows about it, though. Fear of that, fear of going to jail. I don't know about Washington, D.C., but it's getting damn difficult for a drunk to get in jail. It really is. In North Carolina, you got to have connections to get in jail. A drunk ain't got a chance. They'll take him home, even if he don't want to go home. They'll take him home anyway. But it's not that sort of thing. It's not the things that happen on the outside. To me, the thing that makes me hang on is what happened on the inside. The hell of this disease is what happens on the inside. You know, I talked about the differences in this group. But God, aren't there some similarities? Dr. Simsume, what is it that gives the common denominator to all of this? What is it that brings us together? What happened on the inside? When I first came in this program, I was sort of a low-bottom drunk. And when I first came in this program, I used to have a rather uncomfortable feeling about people who weren't. I used to see people who would drive up to a meeting in a car. You know, it didn't have to be a long car, just in a car. People who were still solvent, people who had families, people who'd never been to jail. By the way, 25 years ago in Charlotte, North Carolina, we did a little random survey of our members in that town. How many of you suppose, what percentage you suppose had never been in a jail in their lives? Of AA members, I'm talking about rock 'em, sock 'em, roll in the street drunks. 70% never been in jail in their entire life. But I used to have some awkward feelings about people who still had money and who still had rings and still had families and all that. I used to think they were sort of second-rate members, you know, that they just hadn't really... Talk about reverse snobbery. I didn't really think they paid their dues. Remember Midland, Texas, Hal? We shared a meeting in Midland, Texas a while back. And somebody introduced me to a man after the meeting, and after he left, the fellow said, "You know who you just met?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, nice fellow." Now, Midland, Texas, in case you may not be aware, happens to be the heaviest per capita millionaire center in the world. There are more millionaires per capita in Midland, Texas than any place else in the world, except maybe Abu Dhabi or somewhere. Certainly in the United States. 1,800 out of 80,000 millionaires. This guy, and he said, this is the wealthiest man in this town. His worth that day was $740 million. Can you imagine what that man had to go through to come to a drunk like me and say, "I need help"? Can you imagine? The man could have hired a team of physicians around the clock. He could have bought a hospital. He could have bought every relief and comfort that man could know. God, how he must have suffered to get adequately humble and adequately desperate to say, "I need help. Money won't do it." And that's what I'm talking about. When I consider my alcoholism, fellow alcoholics, it's an inside job. It has nothing to do with the trouble I got into out there. It was the trouble I got into in here. As I watched my life, just like you did, slowly fall apart. And I knew it was happening, but I couldn't face it. Because there's a thing we get locked up in called denial. And it's a profoundly powerful thing. Years back, before we had treatment all over the place, I held an alcoholic in my arms in Gaston County, North Carolina, while he died. And as he died, he was protesting the fact that he wasn't as bad as us. He wasn't really an alcoholic. That's what I'm talking about, that distorted kind of awareness of who we are and that fervent fight from the time I became an alcoholic until I had my last drink. If I took one drink, I was doomed to disaster of some sort, but I didn't know it, and I couldn't face it. But that awareness was going on, and that hopelessness of starting over and trying a new place and a new drink and a new job and new friends, and then watch it fall apart and then try to regroup and start over again. That's the hell of it. That's what I never want to know again. I never want to forget what it was like to be a 21-year-old kid, a time when most folks are just getting started. Exuberant time of life, hopeful time of life, the green years. And the most dominant thought in my life at 21, and I hope to God I never forget it, was utter despair. The feeling that I just wished it were over. I'd look at myself in the mirror and want to throw up. Utter hopelessness and despair at 21. I pray God I never know it again. I pray God I never forget it. The fear.
And I'm not talking about fright of something. I'm talking about fear as a way of life. And that became my life. And it happened on the inside. That fearful kind of thing that made it frightening for me to answer the phone. Well, you hear talked about in AA halls, don't you? The cold knot in the stomach. Wake me at 3 o'clock in the morning and cause me to jump straight up. For no reason. Fear was a way of life. So real I could taste it, couldn't define it, couldn't deny it. It was there. The loneliness of alcoholism. The National Council put out a poster years back that showed a drunk sitting on a park bench, and the caption under it was "The Lonely Disease." And how true it is. That's not a loneliness that's like the loneliness that we normally think about. Every human being in the world knows loneliness, don't they? I'll guarantee you there's somebody sitting in this room today who is not enjoying fellowship. I'll guarantee you that. There's somebody sitting in this room today who is utterly alone and lonely. I'll guarantee you that. Every human being knows it. Alcoholics know an excruciating, unique kind of loneliness that's not quite like others. The loneliness that most folks know has to do with relationships that aren't there. My mother had a stroke a while back, and she's confined to a nursing home. And her life is loneliness. She's a widowed stroke victim who's isolated by her condition, and she knows loneliness morning to night. But that's not the kind of loneliness we're talking about. That's a loneliness that's lifted when I walk in, or any of her family walks in, because all at once the room lights up and the world takes on meaning. Ours isn't like that. Ours is a product of the self-centered condition that we have. Drink by drink, we built ourselves into a glass prison that we couldn't get out of and nobody else could get in. A self-centered prison, in my case, such that I lost the ability to relate to a single human being. I could not nurture or sustain any positive emotion. I could not sustain relationships unless it were a negative, hate-based relationship. I pray God I'll never know that loneliness again. And I don't have to. I don't have to. Much more. That's what my alcoholism was about. That was what happened to me as a human being, as I lost the ability to live. And I reached that sense of hopelessness, fearful loneliness that I pray God I'll never know again. Now, I was a terrible drunk. I was not somebody who drank with any real sense of control. I'm not a typical alcoholic, I don't think, because the typical person in this room probably had a story that went something like, relatively speaking, riches to rags to riches. That's normally what happens. You know, we start out and we do fairly well for a while, and then we lose it. And we hit the bottom, and then we come back up. I was a drunk before I was ever anything. That was the story of my life. And I didn't hit the bottom. I just sort of drug along the bottom. So mine wasn't that way in one sense of the word. All I have to do to see it is just look at the contrast. I remember that bright-eyed kid who walked out of Belmont High School, Belmont, North Carolina, at 16. Confident I was going to conquer the world. And then contrast him to the fellow who 8 short years later, in the city of Flint, Michigan, lived on the streets, a veritable street character,
The most frequent address that I had in my 24th year was the Rialto Theater in Flint, Michigan. Not because I like movies all that much. I'm not even sure they showed any. It was the cheapest room in town, 35 cents. And a drunk could get in off the street. And I've had my shoes stolen in that place. Never believed that I would ever wind up like that, you may be sure. I used to predict that I would not last till I was 30 years old. I was a real character. I don't know of a single thing that a man can do that I haven't done. Never had a teenage. I went from puberty to old age, I think. I don't know of anything that a man can do that I haven't done. I'm not proud of that by any means, but that's exactly the way it was. I was the kind of drunk who had to be brought to a stop. To this day, I have no earthly idea how many times I've been in jail. It equates somewhat roughly to the number of towns that I've been in. Because if I was in a town for as much as a week, I went to jail. I tried to get through Denver, Colorado one day hitchhiking and was arrested 3 times trying to get through town. And each time they'd arrest me, I'd tell them I'm going, and they'd say, if you'll go, we'll let you go. 3 times in Denver in one day. And I was that kind of drunk. It doesn't really matter how many jails I've been in, not even to me, because it really is relative. They were all disgustingly similar. They were all just alike. The thing that's important to me was that I was the kind of drunk who simply had to be brought to a stop. I never want to forget that. I think I would have drunk myself to death had I not been brought to a stop. I don't have any doubt whatsoever. And I was brought to a stop eventually, but unfortunately not soon enough. Because I wound up doing what I think every alcoholic in this world fears doing. I never have met an alcoholic, particularly those who've had blackouts, who hasn't had the rather strong fear that somehow or other in a drunken mess they might wind up irrevocably hurting somebody else. Most drunks are fairly sensitive people. Most drunks really don't want to hurt people. And I think every drunk always has that sort of fear that they might do something that couldn't be undone. Thank God, most don't. But I'm here to tell you that some do. But I woke up one morning in jail, and this was the start of the end for me. I woke up that morning in jail, and I figured that I was in there for the same thing I was always in there for. I'd been in that jail many times. In fact, I was relieved when I would wake up and see that I was there because I knew I was in the right place. And after I was awake for a little while, the jailer came by, a guy I knew well. I asked him when I could get out, and he said, I hope never, and walked off. And I had no earthly idea what the man was talking about. And then a little later on, some of the other fellows in the cell block told me that the night before, driving somebody's car down the main street of that city, that I had run down and killed two young people. I'm not an insensitive man. I'm not going into that, of course. But I guess my reaction was predictable. It was one of just absolute disbelief. I could not accept it. I couldn't deal with it. The grief, the shock was too much, and I just simply pushed it away and said, no, it can't be. And then gradually came to accept the fact that indeed I had done more damage than any drunk ever ought to be allowed to do. Now, I hear a lot of people moaning the blues about getting DUIs. For obvious reason, you may be sure, I have not 1 ounce of sympathy for anybody who gets DUIs. Not 1 ounce. I'd give anything on God's green earth if I'd have had one more. One more. I'd give anything on God's green earth if somebody had just shot me or anything to bring me to a stop. But that was not to be. Now, I did a lot of thinking after that happened. I made up my mind, not in any decisive way, but I just knew that I would never drink again. It's the only time I'd ever been in jail that I didn't try to get out. I didn't want out. I just wanted to hide away. And then after a little while, somebody contacted my folks down in North Carolina. And my mother made what I hope and pray was her last trip to anybody's jail to get her boy out. It wasn't her first one by any means, but I hope and pray it was her last one. And I didn't know how to tell her I didn't want out. She arranged bond. And I was released after 76 days, charged with manslaughter, to await trial. Now, I knew that I would not drink again. I knew that. I know today that I was as sincere as I was capable of being. I didn't think I would be capable of lifting a drink. I stayed sober a day and a half, and then I started back to drinking, of course. And I drank for the next few months like nobody I have ever seen in my entire life. I've worked with thousands of drunks over these past 28 years. I have never worked with one like me. Even that man that I held in my arms as he died was not a drunk like me, because he was fighting. He was fighting even then. And I was a guy who had just given in to his condition. And most people who give in to their condition never come back. Never come back. They move into a league that I seriously doubt that you and I know much about. And that's what happened. I just gave up. And my every waking thought was how to find oblivion by any means, and it mattered not how. And in November the 19th, 1956, I had what I hope and pray was my last drink. Had no earthly idea at the time, but I finished off that morning a little piece of a bottle of gin. And I went to court. It was not to a trial. I had no defense. I didn't even know what I'd done. I just had to let them tell me. And I stood in front of that judge, a fine man, named Steve Roth. He later went to the federal bench and then retired. He's dead now. He was a fine gentleman. And I remember that day clearly. I remember the conversation that we had. And then I remember he came to that point. He sentenced me. I knew that I was to be sentenced. I knew that. There was no question. I think the cruelest thing that could have been done to me that day would have been if Steve Roth had said, just go live with yourself. That's the cruelest sentence that could have been given. Instead, I got a sentence of 5 to 15 years. Now, as you gathered, I was a street character, and going to jail was not anything novel for me. But going to a penitentiary was different. Going to one called Jackson in Jackson, Michigan, is really different. My reaction, I guess, was predictable. I had an instinctive reaction of fear, and I guess that's normal, because going to jail and going to penitentiaries is not the same thing. I guess it was a predictable reaction. It was an instinctive reaction of fear, but almost simultaneously, the most real sense of relief I'd ever known. And not the relief of hope or optimism, but the relief of resignation. I just knew it was done. I knew it was over. And the next day, November 20th, 1956, I walked into Jackson Prison, fully resolved of the fact that I'd never walk out of that place, and honest to God, didn't care. I honestly didn't care. Just a piece of human wreckage being filed away, gone and forgotten, and I never believed I'd ever come out of that place. A man totally devoid of hope, I knew not the feeling. I was a mighty sick young man. I didn't know how sick I was until I started to get well and I started to get my feelings back. I never spoke to a person. I never engaged in a conversation. I sat in my cell like a man in a catatonic state. I just could not carry a conversation. Now, I'm a guy who is deeply grateful for our friends in this program, and thank you folks for being here today. Bill, our co-founder, gave us an admonition years ago. He said, let's be friendly with our friends. And sometimes, as we've grown over the years, we tend to get into an antagonistic relationship, and we get turf guarding, and we get sort of snipey with each other. Let me suggest to you that may be dangerous. I was in a meeting a while back. There were 22 people in the room. And the chairman did something I've never seen in Alcoholics Anonymous. He asked each one of us in that room to think back and identify in our own minds who the first person was that started the chain of events that led to our coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. How many do you suppose had an alcoholic for that person out of 22? Would you believe two? Two. The rest of them are what you'd think, social workers, ministers. I'll guarantee you, you'll see more alcoholics the next year than I will. I'll guarantee you, who are not sober. I'll see more who are sober, maybe. Judges. Wives, God knows. I mean, wives are tremendously influential. Husbands ain't too good at it, you know. Wives are great. I say that because the thing that made the biggest difference for me, the thing that started the ball rolling for me, There was a little old social worker in that prison, a little roly-poly fella named Martin. He looked like the Pillsbury Doughboy. He really did. Little pink cheeks. I always thought if he'd ever come in there as an inmate, somebody would have bought him the first day. He was probably the least knowledgeable of anybody I had ever talked to about my drinking in my life. I had talked to real experts. I mean, every stripe. This little old social worker interviewed me, and I'm sure he did a textbook social worker interview. I did a fairly typical alcoholic response, I'm sure. Lied like a dog. But he made the same diagnosis the experts had. I've never had but one diagnosis in my life. My God, you sure drink a lot. Or something like that. He did the same thing, but then he did something that nobody else had ever done. Now, this was in 1957. And AA was not a deep, dark secret then, but it was not as well known. We were not meeting in the Rayburn Building in 1957. No, no. But it was fairly well known, I guess. I had never heard of it in my life. But that guy got through declaring about my condition, and then he said, "We've got an AA group here, and I think you better go." That was exactly the way he put it. It wasn't an invitation or an order. It was just a flat declarative statement. "We have a group. Think you better go." I had never heard of it. But somehow or other, the image, you know how you imagine what a thing's going to be. Now, I'm not sure what your thoughts were when you discovered you were going to Alcoholics Anonymous. You were probably exuberant, you know, and just said, "Oh, God, isn't that wonderful? I get to go in." I never met a soul that wasn't driven here by somebody. So I wasn't thrilled about it. I could just see this bunch of worn-out old drunks sitting around commiserating with each other. And I don't know. I didn't know what to expect. And I didn't react. I don't know if we're talking more or not. But finally, the appointed day came, Groundhog Day, 1957. I walked into my first meeting. Now, some of it was about what I expected. I knew they were going to pray. I mean, somehow I just knew that if you tried to help drunks, you had to pray about it. I knew that. And they said the same prayer that we didn't say here today. And they read the same stuff that we didn't read here today, that we normally read. And I was a little disappointed. I thought, I really expected somebody to sing the alcoholic anthem. You know, every time I'd ever been around anybody that said they were going to help drunks, it was always clean old men that would come to the county jail. You know what I mean? And they'd come down, they'd say a few words, and then they'd say, "Let's sing a song." And you know what they'd say. "Oh, amazing grace." I could just hear that. I mean, that's just associated with helping drunks, you know. And nobody sang. And I sat down in the middle of that group of people and listened to this going on. And then they introduced the speaker. Now, I don't know what you think about this one. Maybe that's your problem. But whatever you think, I'll guarantee you it couldn't be anything like what I thought. Because I listened to that man who spoke at my first meeting. His name was Shy Walker from Kalamazoo, Michigan. He was without a doubt one of the finest men that I ever met in my entire life. He was a little guy, about 5'6". He had about a third grade education. And I sat there and listened to that man that day tell his story. And I tell you, I had never heard anything like that in my life. I'd listened to drunks tell every kind of story you could imagine, but I had never heard one tell the truth. And that's what he did. But I'm thankful for that man. When I left that meeting that day, if somebody had asked me, "Well, where have you been?" I would have probably said, if anything, "God, you wouldn't believe it. I have listened to a yo-yo talk for an hour." I'm thankful for him, though. Because that man introduced me to something that I think is tremendously important in Alcoholics Anonymous. Enthusiasm. I listened to that man talk about his life. And he didn't need to tell you he was happy. You just knew it. He was one of those rare people that communicates something. That just reaches out and grabs you. And he takes hold of your life and he gives you something. Thank God for that man. Thank God I didn't draw some old bleeding deacon that had quit drinking 30 years before and looked like it. You know what I mean? Now, I don't know about you, but I never did want to be sober. I never did want to be sober. I thought sober was about the most miserable condition a man could suffer. They didn't want to be sober. Everybody I ever saw that was sober looked like they were sober. And they looked like they were in pain. You know that? And I never was one who sat around drunk saying, oh, God, I wish I could get sober. No, no. No, I didn't want to be drunk either. You know, I didn't like that. There's a place that we find that's a sort of about halfway between. And it's nirvana for the alcoholic. It's an elusive plateau that we sometimes reach where we just sort of rise above it all. That's what I wanted to be. I'll guarantee you, fellow alcoholics, if I could have found it, that's where I'd be today. I am not here on moral grounds. But sober, I never wanted to be. That was what's so important to me about Shy, because this guy talked about his life, and you knew that there was something there. And I think that's what it was. I think deep down somewhere there must have been a flicker, and this guy fanned it just a bit. And I kept going to meetings. I never missed a meeting the entire time I was in that place. I stayed there 42 months, and I never missed a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you may be sure for a good while it was not because of any magical solution. It was not because I thought it was a great program for me. I didn't identify. I know none of you ever went through this, but I had that case of terminal uniqueness. I just didn't feel like those other people. And I'd sit there thinking, but y'all don't understand. I understand your case. God knows you're in bad shape. I am glad you're doing all right. But I ain't like that, you know. I'm a very sensitive, feeling person. I'm not like the old drunk. None of you ever felt that. But I sure did. And I felt like I was the only one in there that didn't fit. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I didn't think anybody could be an alcoholic at 24. I was the youngest man in the group for 10 years. I was in this program for over 2 years before I ever heard a single speaker with whom I identified. I mean, one. Yeah. And finally, that one, I don't know. I won't even go into that. I just could not believe it. And I would sit there, and I'd say I was an alcoholic. Yeah, I hated to be the only one in there. It wasn't. And I'd say, yeah, me too, you know, whatever. But it didn't mean anything. It was just words. I've come to believe, and I do believe, in the old notion of act as if. And I don't care if it's as phony as the $3 bill, doctor. I don't care if it's as phony as a $3 bill. Act as if. What I mean by that, I believe if I had waited until I got ready to do the things that I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous, as of today, I would have done a net nothing. Nothing. I have never done one single thing in this program that I felt prepared for. I didn't feel prepared coming here today. Now, you can see now that, folks, I'm operating so far over my head, I get air sick. And that's a fact. And that's just the way it is. The difference is I don't try to act over my head. See what I mean? Act as if. I said I was an alcoholic. I didn't believe that. I didn't believe that. But it made it possible for me to stay here, Jack. Made it possible for me to stay and at least pay my dues and get here. And then, lo and behold, there came a time when I didn't only come to believe it, but I came to know it as the most fundamental fact of my life. I said I believed in God a long time before I did. I never did have enough nerve to tell anybody like the fellow that got in the fight over the chair that was his higher power. Mine was probably more bizarre than that. I didn't have any belief when I came in here. I didn't know the Lord's Prayer. And that's the God's truth. I did not know the Lord's Prayer. The first power that I ever believed in my life was there's something that happens in groups of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's something that happens between alcoholics. And I don't understand it, but again, I feel it. The first power that I ever felt and believed in and prayed to in my life was one that I felt exists between those alcoholic convicts at Jackson Prison. Because I started to observe that here were a group of people who, by their own definition, simply couldn't make it. And yet somehow or other banded together we could. Banded together we could. And I started to feel a warmth, a flowing, a tingle between the people. That's the first power that I ever believed in. Strangely enough, the power that flowed between 300 convicts was the first power I believed in. I didn't understand it, But I felt it, and I believed that it could help me. And that was the extent of my prayer. Act as if. Act as if. I mentioned in the beginning that the paradox is that we die to live, we surrender to win, we give it away to keep it. We really don't work this program. I finally came to a point where I took my fourth step very, very thoroughly. And therein was the starting point for me, because there was a place where it started to solidify. And I knew the day I took that fourth step and took that inventory, looked at myself, I knew that I was an alcoholic. And from that point on, the process of struggle for recovery started. And I fought everything in this program. Nothing fit. Nothing fit. Therein lies the dilemma, though. Therein lies the paradox. Nothing fit. I fought it all. Thank God I lost every fight. And it is only when I would give up and let this thing come into my life that it would work. And it started to work for me. Enough so that the first happy day I ever spent in my life, the first day of genuine happiness, was in Jackson Prison. The first day of freedom I ever knew in my life was in Jackson Prison. Strangely enough, I'm locked up in a cage like King Kong, behind a wall 40 feet high. You couldn't see sunshine but a few hours a day. And I learned what we all learned. Freedom's not something somebody gives you. It's a gift, all right, but it's not a gift that somebody gives you with your body or where you are physically. It has to do with the spirit. And it has to do with my relationship with myself, with my God, with my fellow man. It has a lot to do with responsibility. First freedom I ever knew was there. Well, I got to wrap it up here in about 2 minutes. Now, how do you get from there to here? Well, as Hal told you in the beginning, I'm the head of a prison today. Now, if you don't think it's a long ways from the 39th cell on the third tier of the 8th block of Jackson Prison in Jackson, Michigan, to the head of a correctional institution, your geography is a little suspect. That's a long ways. How do you get there one day at a time, one step at a time? It really is a miracle. I'm trying to think how I can compress this in just a couple of minutes. Let me put it this way. When I left Jackson Prison, I had a deep conviction that I would never go back. Now, I don't mean in a braggadocio kind of way, but I meant that I was willing to do whatever it took to make it in this program, to make it outside. God knows I wanted my freedom. The first job that I had when I left that place was sweeping the floor on the third shift of a cotton mill in Gastonia, North Carolina. And they paid me $1.10 an hour. But it beat the hell out of cutting hair at Jackson Prison for 10 cents an hour. And I'll guarantee you I was the happiest floor sweeper that that mill has ever had. And I was deeply grateful for the great pleasure of that job. I was a good one. I was really good. They hated to lose me. Matter of fact, the irony is that the guy who hired me for that job about a year later became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous himself. And I was sitting in my house one day after I'd been out of Jackson about 2 years, and I was still sweeping floor in that mill. And my telephone rang. Now, I'd been doing some work with an AA group there at a local prison near my house. And I had never considered working in a prison in my life. I never considered being in one either, but I was sitting there, and the phone rang. It was a guy from the state capitol, and he asked for Mr. Ivester. I knew then. I thought he had the wrong number. And he introduced himself, and he said, "We're thinking of expanding the rehabilitation program in our prisons, and we were wondering if you might consider a position." I'd never been offered a job in my life. Not about a job. Unless it by some drunk didn't have one himself, you know, something like that. And I said, "God knows, man, I'd rather do that than anything in the world." And I knew it wouldn't happen. I'd ask him, I said, "You sure you know who you're talking to?" And he said, "Yeah, we probably know you better than you know yourself." And I never believed it would happen. But in November of 1961, I was employed by the state of North Carolina as a rehabilitation supervisor for the next 9 years. I had a tremendously rewarding experience of working with guys like me. I worked primarily with alcoholics. That's where my heart was for about 9 years. And then some people came to me and started to ask me about taking over a prison. And I really never had considered running a prison, as you can imagine. And then finally I said yes. And in 1970, I became the head of the first prison that I headed, a small place in Sanford, North Carolina. And I had the grand experience of watching that become the finest correctional institution that I've ever seen, bar none. I've seen half of them in the country. It's the finest one I've ever seen, including the one I run today. We'll catch it. And then in 77, I opened a youth facility from the ground up. And that's what I do today, folks, just like Al said. You imagine the awe-inspiring nature of that. Now, I've given you my high-bottom story today. I am exactly who I say I am. If you don't understand, if you don't catch anything about what the message is in this, I am where I am because of the grace of God. I am where I am because I believe this is where God wants me to be. I'm here because this program does produce miracles in a very real, pertinent kind of way. And I believe that. I believe that this is part of God's purpose for me. Please don't construe any notion of political kind of connection. Please don't do that. Or don't try to talk to me about it if you do. I knew one politician in my entire state, and that was a sheriff that used to lock me up on a regular basis. And that's it. That's it. From the day I walked into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never applied for one single job. Not one, including the one I've got today. I've never applied. I gave my life to this simple program, just like it says in step five. And this program carried me beyond anything that I could ever have imagined. And let me wrap it up on this note. This program really does work. It works in a thanksgiving of rebirth. It works in a thanksgiving of reunion. I used to sit at Jackson Prison and wonder if I would ever have one friend. Now, this is not rhetoric, folks. This is the God's truth. I wondered if I would ever have one friend. I wondered if there was one person in this world who would ever trust me to do anything. One person that would ever want my company. And I'm happy to report to you that today I do have one friend. In every city in the state of North Carolina. That's the truth. I mean, somebody that cares about me and somebody about whom I care. That I know by name. I'm talking about a person with whom I have a loving relationship. Every city in my state. I have a friend in every state of this nation that I've met personally that I could call up. And their response would be, God, Tom, I'm glad to hear from you. Are you going to come see me? Can you imagine what that means? Can you imagine what it means? Every province of Canada, I have a friend with whom I have a loving relationship. And that's what this program is about. It says somewhere in our literature that not only will we find our sobriety here, but we'll find a useful purpose. And that's what I've had for the past 28 years, is a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning in my life, a sense of joy. And you're looking at a man today for whom this program truly has produced a living miracle. I'm probably having more fun than any 52-year-old man that I've ever known. If you're wavering in the hope department, and if you wonder, no matter where you are in life, but if you wonder if living's ever possible, believe me, it is. Thanks very much.